Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello.
Hello, could I please speak with Terry Tempest Williams?
This is she. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Terry. What a pleasure to have you on the line. Thank you so much for being part of the Quarantine Tapes. I've been looking forward to speaking to you for so long, and I've been thinking about you and your work and thinking the ways in which place matters so much to you. You celebrate place in such an extraordinary way. You make me think of the writers I love most, like Jan Morris and Barry Lopez and Wendell Berry and Pico Iyer. They all write about place in a way that seems very consonant to you. And I'd like to add to that list John Berger, who I spoke to the day after Trump got elected. And he wasn't surprised.
What did he say?
He wasn't at all surprised that Trump was elected. And he said this about place. He said, "I think all desire, including sexual, is a desire to be in a certain place. If only a place consumes us and gives us energy. But when I say place, I don't mean a geographical place. It's where your finger fits or where your foot rests." How does that resonate with you?
I love that so much. Well, of course, I love John Berger. He is such a mentor of mine. So I'm going to have to think about that. I just love the idea of place being not just physical, but emotional and spiritual. And I have found that we are now in, the eighth month, moving on to the ninth month of being in this pandemic. And I think in the beginning months, I saw the pandemic as a pause. And now I see it as a place. And that's been a deep shift for me. You know, the pause brought forth deep reflection in some ways. And I hope you understand this when I say this, both terror and gratitude.
Right.
That we have all been brought home, literally to our knees, to reflect on the madness of our lives. I will speak personally. My life was a life in motion. And I think of that idea that, you know, motion can be a place too. And then I think, you know, the coming together in this pandemic during that pause. And then something shifted and we saw the violence on the streets in this country, the racial injustices, the police brutality, the politicization of the pandemic with this current administration. And then it became a place, and a place wrought with uncertainty and fear and agony, really. And then that place ignited into 5 million acres burning in the American West, as you well know.
Yes.
And then the election. And now this bardo of a new administration wanting to make this transition peacefully, and the old transition that is resisting. You know, so how do we take this place and deepen it and expand it? And for me, that has been about making calls, phone calls, very much like this one. Talking to my family, who are part of the 71 million people that during this pandemic have questioned it, have not changed their lifestyle much, and voted for Trump. And that matters to me, to figure out how to find a place where we can continue a conversation, because I am not one of those who believe we just ignore them. I think we have to embrace them. And I know I have to embrace them around our own dinner table. So that's my sense of a riff from what Berger was saying.
So beautiful.
A place that, as you say, we can call home, no matter how turbulent that may be.
In part because of the turbulence. You write something that speaks to me so deeply, Terry. You say, you write about your willingness not to look away. And that reminded me of both what Werner Herzog said when he said that the poet must not avert his eyes, or Kurosawa, who said to be an artist means never to avert one's eyes, or in fact Kazantzakis, who said the real meaning of enlightenment is to gaze with undimmed eyes on all the darkness. What did you mean when you said a willingness not to look away, and how did you learn it? Because it really feels to me that it's a practice for you.
It's a practice, and it's also what is before us. You know, you and I spoke 2 years ago.
Yes.
In July. I remember it vividly.
Yes.
It was such a generative conversation in July of 2018. Literally, Paul, 2 weeks later, my beloved brother Dan took his life.
Yes.
He hung himself. And that was shattering. We were so close. What do you do with suicide? You know, what? It's an avalanche of questions that can never be answered. And I think one of the gestures, because I think if we choose not to look away, it is met with a gesture. And my youngest brother, Hank, and I made a vow to Dan that we would cremate his body, which is a taboo within the culture that we come from, which is Mormon. And on September 3rd, we witnessed his cremation. We literally went through that process, which was 6 hours, in a very Mormon funeral home that did not welcome this encounter. But what we found was the man who was responsible for the cremations honored our request. And after we were able to spend time with Dan's body, bless it, wash it, sprinkle sunflower petals on his heart, on his throat, on his third eye, and place an owl feather and a red-tailed hawk feather in his hands with his sprig of sage, we literally lifted his body into the retort and closed those doors as the flames took him. And Mr. Rabe, who LDS, Mormon, dressed in a suit with welder's gloves, which is what my family does, weld, lay pipe, allowed us in those 6 hours to experience this. When he opened the door and we were with him, we could see Dan's body. And all I can say is it was like white prayer flags. You know, it was so deadly beautiful. That's what I mean by not looking away. And when he closed those doors, right before he rearranged the bones, closed the doors, we waited another 2-3 hours. And when he opened that door for the last time, Dan's body was gone. It was ash. It was Icarus. It was at that point that we watched him sweep our brother's ashes, bone fragments, into these silver trays. He carried them into this very small white room, and he left us there. And Hank and I felt the last heat of our brother's life. And I will never forget, as we looked at those bones, large bones, small bones, what looked like coral or shell, sand, ash, I looked at Hank and I said, "What are you thinking?" And he said, "Terry, I'm thinking the same thing probably you are. Are these rabbit's bones? Are these raven's bones? Are these coyote?" And, you know, suddenly this most sacred moment became a celebration of all of the hours, days, years that we had spent as siblings in the desert picking up bones, even now our brothers. That's what I mean, Paul, by not looking away. And as we carried his ashes home to our father, they were weighed. They weighed 8.2 pounds, Dan's birth weight, the same weight of a gallon of water in the desert. It's these kinds of semblances, gestures, that I think allow us not to look away. Because in that horror, there are moments of grace. And I think living in an erosional landscape, I mean, as you and I speak, I'm looking at Castleton Tower, the priest and nuns, Harriet Mesa. By not looking away, you see the essence of things. That's what I mean. And I think in this pandemic, we have an opportunity to not look away. And I think that means embracing 240,000 fellow citizens who are dead. The fact that we now in the state of Utah are in a state of emergency. because our state has looked away and now people are dying. So there's consequences if we don't keep that gaze.
What is remarkable, Terry, I mean, there's so many things to say, but what is remarkable is the difference of perception and feeling between your own father at the loss of your brother and you. Your father said to you, Terry, I've finally figured it out. We have to steer down grief.
I loved it when my father called and said that. I mean, literally, I picked up the phone. He didn't say, hello, how are you? You know, he just said, we have to stare it down. And I remember saying, Dad, stare what down?
Yes.
And he said, the pain, the grief. And we have different ways of seeing the world.
Right.
You know, but as you say, it's the same thing. It's daring to touch bone. It's staring it down and not walking away. And I think we're in that place now.
You were talking about how Hank and you were maybe thinking similar thoughts at that moment you recount. And I wonder if recently in this moment, which is a hiatus, as you said, you have had encounters with animals in the wild. You've said animals around us are offering us instructions. I love that. Animals around us are offering us instructions. What do you mean, and how so, and has it happened? And if so, when and where?
You know, being home, which I absolutely love, and it is such a privilege.
Yes.
To be home and in a beautiful place like this. It's also remote. And so I've left once with my father when he called in September and said, can you give me a ride to Wyoming? It's such a Western thing, right? Sure. Drive up 5 hours to Salt Lake, pick him up, drive another 5 up to Wyoming. But I have not left. I have not left. And I've seen a handful of people. That's it. A few neighbors. And so most of our companions now are animals and birds and plants. And here's, may I share a story with you?
Shall I say no? Of course, please.
Well, please. When you ask, you know, what do animals have to teach us or instruct us?
Yes.
So there was this huge windstorm. This was probably a month ago. And we have this desert willow or coyote willow, and it has these beautiful magenta blossoms on it, maybe an inch or 2 inches high. They look kind of like big snapdragons. Anyway, they were everywhere on our patio, stone patio, just littered, you know, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, the patio's turned pink. And all of a sudden, I saw one of the petals move, and I thought, how strange, it's not windy, there's no breeze. And I started to follow this moving flower, moving blossom. And it was being carried by the tiniest ant. I cannot tell you. I mean, less than a half inch, maybe a quarter of an inch. It was carrying this enormous blossom in its mandibles, perched now over its head. It looked like a sail. And I thought, this is the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. It was so beautiful. And I thought, I'm going to follow it. And for the next, it must have been at least a half an hour. I don't know. But I followed this wee little thing carrying this willow blossom across the stone patio, over a chasm, and just at the chasm where the patio meets the desert, I thought, this is it. It's going to fall over. It's going to smother. That's it. Out of nowhere came 3 other ants to help this ant carrying the flower over that chasm. And it took some time. And then it was back on its path, on this stone path. And then it kept going, and I could see up ahead, and I thought, oh no, this is going to be it. There was a huge prickly pear cactus patch. I thought, that's it. It's going to be stabbed. The blossom is going to get hung up on the spines. And as it moved and navigated through this harrowing patch of cactus, again, 2 other ants appeared out of nowhere and helped lift that blossom through the maze of the prickly pears, and then disappeared. They went on their way. And I just kept following the determined ant with this blossom around where our offices are, down a little gully, up, and then to where the ant colony was, which looked like a fist rising out of the desert floor. It climbed up that hill, and again, ants, this time maybe 6, helped hoist that blossom up the hill, It got to the entrance and laid it down at the entrance, almost like a bow. And there, a multitude of workers met that ant that had laid that blossom at the entrance. And they immediately began cutting it up into tiny, tiny bits, carrying those bits down into the labyrinth of the colony, where I suspect they were being used, those petal pieces were being used to line the entrance to the queen.
You know, what is so remarkable about this story, I mean, there's so many parts that are remarkable. First of all, you're telling, but also as an illustration, not only of how this moment offers indeed instructions, but also that you just demonstrated what it means not to avert one's eyes. And you have said something that I find so beautiful, where you say you can find optimism in paying attention.
It was so beautiful, Paul, you know, and ongoing. I mean, think of everything that is happening around us that we don't see in the natural world. You know, that's what just undoes me in the most beautiful of ways. And as terrifying as this pandemic is, and as heartbreaking as it is, and I should tell you, Hank had COVID in March, and we almost lost him. He only has one lung. You know, my family has a construction business. They lay pipe for oil and gas. He was in Tucson and contracted desert fever, and it turned into pneumonia, and he lost a lung in 2015. So we knew he was vulnerable, and in fact, he did get COVID, and he almost died. And his will, you know, who knows how he survived. He says he survived because of his two dogs that never left him. Because he refused to go in the hospital because he was in for 35 days when he lost his lung and almost died. But I just knew we had to get Hank to the desert. And we were finally able to get him here. And he lived with us for 3 months as he recovered. And when he arrived, we could barely get him from the car to the room where he would stay. And when he left, he was walking 9 miles a day, and the wonders that he would see, you know, the scratching of badgers on the arroyo walls, the cavorting of ravens, golden eagles, even a bald eagle in the middle of, you know, on the edge of the Colorado River, dousing itself with water in the middle of a drought. I mean, I just feel that this is how we are surviving. If we can be in these places of renewal, you know, even the fires of the summer. I was asked to write an obituary for the land. And what I realized is I was writing an obituary for us, because even as those trees burn, they are dropping seeds that are already starting their renewal. And that's where I'm finding strength and presence in this larger community of plants, animals, rocks, rivers, and human beings.
Terry, you wrote a beautiful book that everybody must read immediately. It's an urgent request, called Erosion, Essays of Undoing. And in it, I mean, I could quote so many passages, but I'll quote one to start out with. You say, wilderness offers us a template to an enlightened citizenship. Instead of caring for ourselves, we are invited to care for species other than our own. We are encouraged to look to the roots of things. Care is tied to the German root word Chara or Kara, which means to grieve or to lament. To care about wilderness is to grieve over what we have lost. To care about wilderness is to fall back in love with the world and lament how lost we are and how lonely we have become.
It's right before our eyes, and we so often fail to see it. And whether it's in cities, whether it's in wilderness, whether our own garden, or in a place like Castle Valley where we live, it is right before us all the time. And I feel such deep gratitude for it. And, you know, 2 hours south of us is Indian country, the Diné, Navajo country. And, you know, during the Bears Ears fight, and I'm going to call it that, you know, the request, the plea from Native people, five Native nations, you know, Dene, Hopi, Zuni, Ute Mountain Ute, Ouray Ute, asking for these lands, these sacred lands, to be protected. And it was met with a proclamation by President Obama, as you know. 1.3 million acres were protected and saved. And I remember Jonah Yellowman, who is one of the spiritual leaders, said, you know, we are not protecting these lands for our people, but all people, because this is the site of our healing. And I haven't forgotten that, nor have I forgotten Willie Gray Eyes, who now is a county commissioner, who lives in one of the most remote areas in the lower 48 at Navajo Mountain. When he won the election, people, and I will say that I call them, they are my people, white frontier Mormons in this case, said that he was not a resident of San Juan County. Can you imagine? His family has been there for generations. And they took him to court, saying this was an illegitimate election. What was his defense before a Trump-appointed conservative underscore judge? I belong to this land. I am a resident of this county because this is where my umbilical cord was buried. You should have heard the laughter in the courtroom. But slowly, as his defense unfolded, the tenor shifted. And in the end, the judge awarded the election to Willie Gray Eyes, saying this is not only a legitimate election, this is the kind of residency that we all should aspire to. This is what dwelling looks like. And, you know, it's these kinds of stories of deep relations in the land that can inspire all of us to have a deeper sense of what dwelling means.
Yes.
And during this pandemic, I think we have the opportunity to see this as a transformative time, as well as a deeply harrowing time, but that the seeds of renewal are beneath our feet.
I love what Willie Gray Eyes told you. He said, this can no longer be about anger. It has to be about healing. And you yourself have said, I'm constantly asking myself, how do I take my anger and transform it into sacred rage?
That is my biggest question, Paul. You know, and with a name like Tempest, it's not easy.
Yeah.
But I mean, I felt angry so much of the time, and I keep thinking about Willie. You know, what does healing look like? And I remember he was saying, you know, because I said that sounds too passive for me. And he said, but if you have a splinter in your heel and don't take care of it, if you don't excise it, then it festers and becomes so infected you can't even walk. You know, and then he explained, you know, we need to go to the source of our pain, and therein lies our healing. And for Native people, you know, as Willie and I have continued the conversation, you know, as a country, as the United States of America, now the divided states of America, our government has never apologized for the cultural genocide of Native nations, in the same way reparations have not been made to Black people. You know, I mean, we have a violent history, and yet I do believe that the human heart is the first home of democracy, and that we can gather ourselves to make amends in the appropriate ways, and that is the beginning of our healing. And maybe that's the source of my own anger in my own culture that, you know, is racist, that I've had to confront my own white supremacy. And in Erosion, there's a deeply difficult essay for me called Boom, recognizing how Utah is a beautiful violence. So these are not easy times, but I believe that these are conscious times, and that if we can elevate our consciousness, both personally and collectively, that it will have consequence. I mean, and I think that's where we find ourselves at this moment.
I mean, you say something so beautiful. You say, I think about anger as also a sibling to grief. And because you love John Berger, I will read you a very short paragraph of his in 10 Dispatches about Endurance, where he says, Terry, happiness is not something to be pursued. It is something to be met, an encounter. Most encounters, however, have a sequel. This is their promise. The encounter with happiness has no sequel. All is there instantly. Happiness is what pierces grief.
Again, the pause.
Which I love.
I just, I want to think about that. You know, happiness, that's such a, you know, I was raised in a culture where the goal was to be happy, and I don't feel that anymore. So I want you to send me that passage. I really want to.
You will get it.
To study it. You know, and I feel that way about hope. You know, for me, it's not so much about hope, but knowing where hope dwells. And I was reading John Freeman's Dictionary of Undoing, and I loved his definition of hope, which I also think could apply to happiness, which is that hope is an energy field. And I was reading about how hope is emotion. Mm. Or no, excuse me, grief is an emotion. And for me, I feel like grief is what I walk with. Grief is the raven on my shoulder that is always present. And I think these words, you know, hope, grief, happiness, settle for me in what Octavia Butler, in her parable of the sower, when Lauren, in writing the Earthseed journals, writes, God is change, change is God. And that brings us back to this sense of erosion, that we are eroding and evolving at once. You know, that's where my peace is held. Where is yours held, Paul?
So much by listening to all these stories, you know, by listening as carefully as I can. I learn by listening in this way. It reminds me that what is important is to surround oneself with people who are wise, not necessarily of this moment. So this deep relationship you have with the land, with place, you make me long for it.
And where do you go? What do you see as your place? I mean, certainly as you're talking about the stories, the people that you surround yourself in, but in terms of a physical place, where do you go in your mind or with your feet?
I'm still looking. You wrote just the day after the election, you wrote this beautiful piece called Wind Applause, and you finish it with these lines, and perhaps you could even read a moment or two from it. The last lines are, but the path to protecting Mother Earth is a beautiful one because it is aligned with love. Wind Applause is circulating the planet. And for our listeners, I must say, you wrote that piece out of a sense of relief, I imagine, and perhaps of joy of what this moment and this election has brought about. Might you?
I also wrote it as in friendship. And a friend of mine, Chloe Arregis, who's the daughter of the poet, the Mexican poet, Homero Arregis, and his wife, Betty Arregis. You know, I've known her since she was a small girl, you know, and we've grown up together, even though we haven't seen each other for a long time. And she emailed me and just said, Terry, we're on, you know, we've just crossed over in this election. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to write something for our community. She's now in the UK, part of Writers Rebel. And so I wrote it for her. I don't know if I would have written something, because I think we've all been in such a state of uncertainty and relief and the full gamut. But I think there's something to be said in this moment about saying yes when we might want to say no, or we think we can't do this. But I made a commitment with this pandemic that as a writer, I would say yes to whatever I was asked to do, because that's all I can do. And so this came out of a yes. And may I read a part of it?
Yeah, I was going to say, can you leave us with a moment in it? I read it with such joy yesterday, and I'm happy that you will end our call, alas, today with that moment of yours.
I'm just going to read maybe three paragraphs that are disparate, but you will understand. When the news finally came that the Democratic candidate, Joe Biden, had won the state of Pennsylvania, putting him over the 270 electoral college votes needed to win the United States presidential election, our household cheered. I ran outside, not to the streets, because where we live, there are none, but because in some irrational state of mind, I wanted to let the Wildlands community know that a breathing space was coming. I wanted to let the red sandstone mesas and cliffs and the western public lands that stretched out before me, that in so many ways define America's natural character, there was going to be a safer environment under a Biden-Harris administration. But the minute I opened the door, I was met with wild applause, a howling, a whistling, singing maelstrom of air, moving every grass, every finger of sage, every twisted and gnarled juniper and pinyon pine in a wild, energetic dance. A congress of ravens was in full aerial display, playing with the boisterous currents in dramatic dives, swerves, and quick-moving glides with sharp-edged wing banks to secure their positions as they repeated their avian maneuvers all over again. It was impossible not to read the signs as celebratory. And then it goes on to talk about what we can hope for. And then I say, we have seen the power of the youth with their cries for climate justice, calling for action, not words. We have seen demonstrations, manifestations in every country around the globe, flowing like water in the streets of our towns and cities, eroding complacency as the world burns. And we have witnessed the rise of the seas, the drowning of islands, the frequency and ferocity of hurricanes, the devastation of floods and fires. We, the people everywhere, must take our concerns and turn them into sacred rage. By that, I mean an energy born out of fire that transcends anger and elicits compassion for the only home we will ever know, Earth. Earth now, not Earth in the future, not Earth as we have seen it in the past as a floating body in space, but Earth as our own bodies on the ground and on the line of every decision we now make. Time is up. Time to get back to the daily work of resistance and insistence that change happens, especially in this pandemic that is no longer a pause but a place to reflect on how our collective sickness infecting our species is not something outside us, but inside us. Our healing will be contingent not just upon a vaccine, but a change in consciousness. The help of the earth is the help of each other. And then that last paragraph that you read, we have great work before us, and we too will be met with unexpected allies to help us with the obstacles we face. This goes back to the ant story, Paul. May the spirit of decency, urgency, and empathy carry us forward. The extinction crisis and climate chaos affecting all species is perilous and unprecedented, but the open path to protecting Mother Earth is a beautiful one because it is aligned with love. Wild wind applause is circulating the planet.
Terry, my gratitude. Thank you so much. It's been a real, real pleasure to speak to you again, and as they say in French, jamais deux sans trois, never two without three. So I look forward to our third conversation, maybe even in person. I so remember vividly, as do you, as you said, when we spoke about your magnificent book, but not only about that, about so many things, When Women Were Birds, which everybody must read, and Erosion, which everyone must read, and they must just follow you. They must just follow you. They must just follow what you write and what you think. We need you. Thank you so much.
And Paul, I love you. We've never met. I love our conversations. And I am so grateful for the place of listening that you create for us. It is changing us and allowing us to believe that this moment of reckoning is also a moment of awakening. So thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you. Stay safe.
Take special care.
You too.
I hate to hang up. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.